I'm in over my head. They've taken everything that I've had to give, and they say it's over. But man, I'm still here living. That's lit. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Jays in over their heads a little bit, but a pretty competitive series against the Yankees. Nonetheless, they split the first two and then go to extra innings in the series finale after like a two-hour rain delay, after intentionally walking Aaron Judge about 100 times over the course of the series. They won 8-5 on Friday. Another rough one for Kevin Gausman, but the bullpen comes up. Aaron Judge and Anthony Volpe both homer. Marcus Stroman was rough on the other side. Vlad stayed hot. Saturday rolls around, 8-3 loss. Jose Berríos has a rough one. Judge, Volpe, Grisham, all homer. It gets to the point where the Jays intentionally walk Aaron Judge with nobody on base and two out, which became a talking point. That one as well. Vlad continued to stay hot. Single, double, and a homer. Vlad, by the way, is now in the best 37-game stretch of his career. And of course, 37 games is cherry-picking a little bit. But if we compare it to his best 37-game stretch from 2021, when he came second in most valuable player voting and the Blue Jays were playing in different ballparks and things like that, this stretch by RBI, extra base hits, slugging, batting average, however you want to chop it up, WRC plus if you want to control for league environment and park factors and things like that, best stretch of his career. 2021, he sustained it for like 55 games, so we'll see. A couple weeks of work to do here, but this is close to the best Vlad has been over an extended stretch. So much so that he went 1-for-5 with a double on Sunday, and it was his second worst game of the last like 4 weeks. Anyway, Sunday rolls around. They lose 4-3 in extras. Yariel Rodriguez, a step forward. 4 2/3 inning, so he has a rough first inning. Ends up going 4 2/3. Nobody on, 2-0 for Juan Soto. They take him out. He was really upset about it. Him and John Schneider both talked about it after the game. John Schneider saying, well, with his pitch count in the high 70s, he wasn't coming out for another inning. They were going to walk Aaron Judge anyway, so this gave them two opportunities with Brandon Little, lefty on lefty, versus Juan Soto or Austin Wells. It didn't work out. He ended up walking both of those guys in addition to the Judge intentional walk, so Zach Pop had to come in and get out of it. And then also, you know, hey, today's the second off day in a five-day stretch. The bullpen's fresh, so why not go to a reliever there? My main take on this is that I like that Yariel Rodriguez was upset about it. I want a pitcher who wants that matchup. He wants to face Juan Soto a third time. He says, hey, the bases are empty since the first inning I've been dealing. Let me have this guy. Let me get this guy out. So, you know, there's pitch count and inning limit things with Yariel Rodriguez. The team is going to have to work through all season, but I like at least that Yariel Rodriguez wanted to stay in there and was pretty fired up about it. No game today, so let's break down some of what's been happening with the Blue Jays from a pitching standpoint with our favorite pitching analyst. It's Lance Brozdowski of Marquee, of Lance Broz on YouTube, Substack, everywhere else on socials. How we doing, man?
Hey, what's going on? Good to see you.
Yeah, you too, man. So let's start with Yariel Rodriguez. This is one of the more fascinating guys coming into the season. Obviously didn't pitch competitively in any league play last year. You know, quick stint to minors, right to the majors out of, you know, Cuba by way of Japan. What have you made of the 11 starts or so we've seen of Yariel Rodriguez so far at kind of a high level first?
Yeah, he's actually been a pretty tough pitcher, I think, to evaluate overall. You know, he's got this kind of cut fastball, cut right fastball, which has become pretty popular, I think, in the league among teams that prize and value more sweeper shapes. So those guys who generally get on side of the ball and their fastballs are able to create good break, a good velocity on their sweepers that go off that. But he's tough to evaluate because he's a guy that is relatively low stuff, and he's also like not a pinpoint command guy. So I think a lot of the time what he's trying to do is just create weak contact with the fastball that's, you know, in some ways a cutter, and then get to the sweeper off that to generate swing and miss versus righties. He's done a really good job getting that fastball up into lefties. You know, the results, I think, overall have been pretty good from watching him and seeing him a couple times. I watched a bit of that outing yesterday. I was a bit surprised he was pulled. I think the Blue Jays have a tendency to do that. I seem to remember that Jose Berríos pull.
Yeah.
For Ryu, was that last postseason? I remember that was a big topic of debate.
Sure was.
So they tend to probably rely on the data and the numbers to lean on going towards matchups rather than extending pitchers. But, I mean, that's a general league trend. I don't necessarily think there are a lot of organizations that will push, I wouldn't say a young pitcher, even he's like, what is he, 27 years old, but a guy with minimal experience. So the results have been solid here. I mean, I think that models kind of just miss on these guys sometimes in terms of being able to create, again, that weak contact off that fastball shape. The Cubs are super big on this particular kind of fastball, where it just isn't your standard shape. Therefore, maybe models aren't really accounting for it in a way that does a good job of picking how it's going to perform. But I think that's one of the primary reasons why he's under a 40, right?
And then there's also, I mean, I'd imagine from a modeling standpoint, something that's fascinating. It's one of the reasons he's so fun to watch in addition to the intensity, but the delivery changes. He's throwing that fastball from different arm angles. The leg kick is a little different, or the timing's a little different. Those guys who, you know, I'd assume it's more he's trying to mix it up and keep hitters off balance than like the delivery's not repeatable. It seems intentional, but how difficult is that kind of extra layer if a pitcher is trying to do something a little funky to that a hitter can't pick up, that we don't have a way to capture it?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, that is part of the reasons why I think it's tough to evaluate, because you have a lot of variance in the shape. So what that does is essentially makes your average less, you know, predictable of what you will see going forward if he's changing shapes. And I remember seeing this at the beginning of the year too, and writing about him, where he had some fastballs that like looked incredible. You know, they had a ton of carry. They were a little bit harder than like the 94-ish usually sits. And I was like, ooh, I would just want that a ton. And I think that's one of the reasons, if you go back to like the data and the pitch design side, it's like a lot of the time what you're trying to do is get consistent shape. And the reason you're trying to get that consistent shape is that in a sample of whatever you throw, there's probably a shape in there that's better. So why don't we try to get to that better shape more? And now obviously maybe there's some advantage to having variance and having what Yariel has, which is, you know, arm slot variance, shape variance, et cetera. But I wonder whether there's like a better version of what he does if he just leans on the pitches that are better and like sparingly uses the ones that aren't as good, you know, especially on that four seam shape and the variance he has on it. Go towards the one that's a little bit harder with more carry, you know, put that at the top of the zone, and then maybe try to lean off the one that you're cutting more, that's a little lower velo, that's more middle for weak contact. Maybe that's a better overall pitcher, but I don't know. It's nitpicking on a guy who's done pretty well this season.
It's fascinating to try to put yourself in the hitter's perspective, right? Like, what would you rather hit against? The one shape that is toughest to pick up, or you got to deal with a couple different shapes, and like some of them might be easier, but you got to pick it up, right? It's an interesting trade-off, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's like with the shape that's really good, seeing that over and over, you would expect that to be better, but do you as a hitter get better against that individual shape the more you see it? Or are you more thrown off if there's variance in it, even if the variance you're seeing is a worse pitch? Like, I'm not sure what the equation is, you know, and how that would work out for a general hitter. I would imagine that most teams just want the best pitch as much as possible, because you'll just pull the guy after four and two-thirds innings, as they did with the Yariel. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
It's like, I don't really need you to like vary to the point where we're throwing hitters off when you see them for the third time. But maybe that's just me, the front office mind in me.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably accurate. Why do you need stuff for a third time through? We're only going to let you do that in April and June, and definitely not ever in October. Okay, so outside of the fastball is obviously the big pitch. Throws it 45% of the time. You know, pretty solid results against it. When we look at what he complements that with, so he's got slider, curveball, splitter, and then he'll throw a sinker as well, in addition to kind of those alternating fastballs. The curveball has some rough results against it so far. Do you see anything in there with respect to the curveball, the way he's using it, that is a bit of a red flag? Like, the slider has been so much more effective than the curveball so far.
Yeah, I'd say most of the time, curveballs are tough when they're not thrown really hard. His is 78. So for me, a lot of the time, those pitches are generally just early count, unless you're creating like massive, massive shape. You know, if you just look at, I believe, curveball shapes in like situations, first pitch of an at-bat, the take rate on those is really high. So if you could zone the pitch at about league average rate, like say 50 to 55% of the time on a slower curve, that allows you to just kind of steal strikes and get up 0-1. And guys generally swing at that very little. And curveballs are also relatively tough pitches to hit from like a barrel standpoint. Slow curveballs are generally just that for me. You know, when you get into, I'm putting together like a top 40 pitching prospects right now. And a lot of the eval for that comes down to like, what are you doing with your shapes, you know? And a lot of the time you'll see a lot of curveballs and mixes that I just don't really think have too much utility outside of that early count situation. The harder curveballs, the River Rines of the world, a couple other guys, Takeo Roby from the St. Louis Cardinals is another one. These are like 82 to 84, and they possess similar shape to most other curveballs that are 4 miles per hour slower. Those pitches I like, because those pitches you can use against righties because they're hard. You can use them against lefties in deep count situations. You can use them in 1-1 situations if you think you can steal a strike with it and it's not going to get barreled. They push outside of that 0-0 situation. That's what makes them really good. So I don't know his usage off the top of my head in non-barrel situations, so to speak, or non-barrel situations, non-like hitter advantage situations. But I'm curious if he's using them in spots that necessitate some damage because of the point that it's not particularly hard, and therefore it's probably just to get me over shape.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to track, especially now that, you know, hey, there's the other thing too is like you throw it and then you have to get to like a critical mass of them before you can even say like, oh yeah, it's not particularly effective. There's something wrong with it, or not even something wrong, but like I should use this differently and things like that. So so one of the other reasons that the Blue Jays pulled Yariel Rodriguez after 4 2/3, it wasn't just the third time through and the bullpen being rested and stuff like that. He was at 76 pitches and they've been very careful with his pitch count. Again, he's probably they've used 100 as like a rough innings limit this year and things like that, given that he didn't pitch competitively in game action last year. But I would imagine down the stretch here, they want to see him in longer outings a little bit. When you are looking at that, again, putting the front office stuff aside, where you're probably not in a playoff game going to see a guy a third time through the order unless you're an ace, what are you looking for as a guy extends into the eight? Like if next time out the Jays say, we're going to let him go 100 pitches if he's pitching well, what are you looking for? Is it holding velocity? Is it the pitch efficiency? When a guy's going to expand from being a 70-pitch guy to, say, a 90, 95-pitch guy?
Yeah, it's a great point. I velocity is obviously one that I imagine he would be able to hold if they're going to push him into those situations.
He did yesterday.
Probably done. Yeah, yeah. So that makes a lot of sense then in that respect of like, okay, we're pretty confident he can hold velocity at 90 plus, so let's let him roll. The thing I'm watching is more so how hitters react to the shapes he's throwing and if he's continuing to show similar shapes and usage to what he did first and second time through. Because if you're turning over lineups more, generally most guys, even like the best, even if you look at like a Paul Skeens, like he'll play around with his mix. His stuff even falls off from a performance standpoint. As he turns over lineups, like his fastball becomes an easier pitch to put in play. That's one of those kind of similar situations that he runs into from like a lineup turnover perspective. But his mix and command are deep enough for that to work. With Yariel, there isn't a ton of like location variance from what I saw. As I mentioned, like that four seam kind of sits up in. So like it gets back to the point we were just talking about with the curveball, where it's like if you see it a bunch, then like it's one of those things where maybe it just becomes easier to combat. So if you're not mixing locations, you're not mixing usage, you're not going to other pitches that you can strike in particular, you know, then you run into some situations where I'm just assuming that you're going to do the same thing over and over. And at that point, you're hoping that somehow the hitter didn't totally key in on what you were throwing in the first or second time through. So I'm looking at more usage relative to what he's done in the past, early in first and second AB of game versus particular hitters, like batter versus pitcher matchups. And also I'm looking at location, seeing if there's any variance there. It's like, you want to try to go outside with the four seam? Is there some way to throw the sinker in another situation or another spot? You know, can the slider be located in a different spot? Can you go down in with it as opposed to backdoor? Like a lot of the problem with those spot like ideas is that if you don't have like stellar command, a lot of those misses pull you back into the middle of the zone where most damage occurs. So like if he wants to try to go backdoor with a sweeper to the lefty all of a sudden, as opposed to try to bury it more down in, like is his command good enough such that that's not going to just going to run back to the middle of the plate and he's going to get barreled? Like that's in an ideal world, the pitcher has the command to be able to spot things and protect them from being bad misses, so to speak. But the reality is there's very few guys that can actually do that, you know, and a lot of other guys are just mixing hitters to death or turning usage over in ways that allows them to take advantage of you just not seeing another pitch that I haven't thrown yet. So there's a lot of like game theory element to it of like playing with mix and playing with location to get you to a point where hitters are just unfamiliar with what you're throwing. It's just Fangraphs location plus has him with like a below average level of command. So that's the situation I would be watching. It's just like he's probably going to do a similar thing. Maybe that's part of the reason why the Blue Jays have some hesitancy to like let him turn over the lineups the third time.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to track that, you know, with the kind of learning to pitch element. And yeah, you've got a guy on that bench in Chris Bassitt who like, yeah, I can go a third time through the order because I throw 8 different pitches and I'll throw them in different counts and different locations.
Exactly.
And stuff like that. And sometimes, you know, I don't know, those 8 pitches might actually be like 10 pitches depending on the day. So another guy who's going through this challenge as well, someone I asked you about briefly last time your arm was Bowden Francis. And at that point, he had just been toying with introducing a splitter. He ends up getting sent to the minors, dominates at AAA, and would not be the first guy to dominate at AAA and then struggle at the major league level. He last time out had the longest outing of his career at 5 2/3 innings. Wasn't like anything wild. We look into some of the pitch specific stuff. You know, the splitter has not great results so far. None of the pitches really have great results. What are you seeing with Bowden Francis. He's a guy that I've thought could maybe turn it into an SP5 kind of role, but the longer this goes on, looks like maybe the future is a multi-inning reliever type. What have you seen with Bowden Francis?
Yeah, I remember talking about him with you earlier this season, and it goes back to the point I was just talking about. Like, his primary break is like this massive curveball, which is like 74-ish, which is even slower than what I was talking about the RAL at 78. I struggle. The sample of guys who throw really slow curveballs as their primary breaker is very low. So I just don't like that. This archetype of pitcher, I'm not totally like in love with a lot of the time. The angles he has going for him are the fact that he's got good extension. You know, he carries the ball pretty well. He has a couple shapes. I like that splitter development for sure, in terms of just being able to throw something else that I think is a harder pitch that will probably be better than the curveball long-term, in my opinion, even though the curveball grades out well and stuff. I'm rarely sold on like 74 mile per hour curveballs being your primary breaker and you becoming a starting pitcher. You know, you're talking about like Adam Wainwright right there. Like, I don't really know how, like, I guess Jordan Montgomery, but like, he doesn't throw a big loopy curveball. Like, his is like a short, tight shape. It's more like a slider, but it's tagged as a curve. So it's just like sub 75 mile per hour curveballs as primary pitches in a repertoire are tough for me. So in that respect, I'm not entirely sure. The other way you could just do it is just jump up velocity a little bit. Like, I think he sits like 92, 93-ish.
Yeah.
Like, if he's more like a 93, 94 guy, that's going to help protect just kind of everything else he does. Other thing I noticed looking at him too is that his release height's down a bit from earlier in the season. You know, I'm not entirely sure why this is happening. I don't know if he had like anything injury side, but
not since very early on.
So it's one of those things where you'll see guys throughout the season drop sometimes. It's just like a level of fatigue sets in, but perhaps they're working on something mechanically there to get him slightly more kind of sweep on everything. Like, I think his fastball lost a little bit of shape, but that probably is evened out by the fact that he's from a lower release. And like, vertical break from a given release height is often one of the ways you look at quality of fastball. So as long as he's not, if he's still above average for the level of release he's at, which he is, then I don't think it's too much of an issue there. But it's something to monitor from like a, I don't know, I'll keep an eye on some reporting around the beat in Toronto as to whether like they're working on anything mechanically or they just want him lower. Perhaps they think that helps everything a bit more. This is something we saw with like Hunter Green. He's a really tough pitcher to eval because he didn't really change too much this season, Hunter Green. I don't mean to change topic, but getting to the point that the only thing I see that's different there is that his arm slot's slightly lower and he maintained all his shape. So, like, is there something there in terms of the angle and visual hitters are seeing from a slightly lower release that helps everything, that helped him basically cut his home run rate in half? Like, maybe there's some idea of that to apply to Bowden here, where it's, the results aren't obviously in the Hunter Green level. Yeah. You're not entirely confident he's like the SP5 of the future, but if they like this lower slot better, perhaps they're trying to get at something that, you know, it seems like the Reds got it with Hunter Green.
Yeah, and we'll see how that plays. You know, introducing the splitter more, he wasn't using it at all at the start of the season. Maybe the way that plays off the fastball from that slot, and it is a bit of a rise fastball. We'll see. It's weird, too. The fastball has, like, given up a lot of home runs, but otherwise, like, it's his best pitch by run value. He's been obviously, anytime a guy is changing roles, bullpen to starter and going up and down and things like that, it makes it a little extra, complicated to kind of evaluate him on the fly. One other Jays starter I wanted to ask you about, and this is maybe back to your point with Yariel and extending a guy out. You know, are your misses good misses, or are they missing toward the center of the zone? You did a write-up on Jose Berríos two starts ago, and at that point, the numbers were pretty rough over his last few starts. It's only continued that way. He's got a 6.16 ERA over his last nine starts. After that unbelievable start, his ERA is now up over four on the season. He's second to Cutter Crawford in home runs allowed in all of baseball. What have you seen with Jose Berríos? I know you did the write-up at your Lance Braz Substack, but for our purposes here, where are the red flags with Jose Berríos of late?
Yeah, the main thing I realized there is just that this slurve location to lefties was not normally where it is. That was the big thing. It's just, it's tough with pitchers like him, where you have a decent track record of success. So it's like when I'm doing those write-ups, like I don't want to propose something when the guy's like performed pretty well with a mix that looked pretty similar to what he's currently throwing. You know, he's had really good stretches in his career, not really doing anything different than he is. So a lot of the time what I'll go to there is just looking at location. Like, are you putting something in a different spot than you normally do? And is that affecting how the rest of your repertoire plays? You know, he has a lot of what you call overlap between where he's throwing his fastballs and where they're allowing damage, which is always slightly concerning. The problem there is just like, you're not going to assume that he's going to totally move his fastball location just because of that. And that gets to the point that perhaps the slurve, especially the lefties where he's having some problems, was just in a spot that doesn't necessarily help other things that he's throwing. it's more, so you think like throwing down into a lefty, that's where he normally puts that pitch. And that's where the break of that pitch is normally going to take him. He started throwing that pitch more like down away, which almost seemed to me like he was trying to backdoor it more for like called strikes. But I mean, he goes from being in the shadow with a pretty good pitch to now being in zone. And like in theory, that should work. But I wonder whether it's a matter of if he's throwing the four seam kind of more up away and the sinker down away, like now you kind of are sitting on one lane of the plate. And I would imagine from a visual standpoint, it's a little easier to pick up the slurve coming out and around that outer third line, so to speak, as opposed to helping in like starting on that outer third and then coming down in, as I said. So I don't know. I didn't check the last couple starts to see if that was fixed and he's still struggling. But that was the big thing that jumped out to me. It's just like, you got to watch the slurve location there. Like that's just got to be a pitch that's got to be down in.
Yeah, and it didn't look particularly better last time out either. The Yankees really got to him on the weekend, gave up three bombs. That is a work in progress. So when it comes to a guy like Brio, so I mean, I know he had a bad 2022, but he figured it out. And he has like 7, 8, 9 years now of being the same guy and mostly being effective with this. How, if you were on the team side, how hesitant are you to tweak that much or change that much when a guy has had success with the same kind of mix and approach? This is a leading question because we're going to talk about a guy who just left the Blue Jays in a minute and has tweaked his pitch mix already. But when a guy has had the track record and things like that, are you a little slower to suggest major changes versus just kind of letting them figure it out in ebb and flow?
Yeah, I think I would be, for the particular fact that he has a ton of experience doing pretty well with a particular mix, you know? So it's like, I got to be, if you're proposing a change, you got to be like really confident that it's going to help. And you're getting, I think, somewhat to a situation where I have this thing in a lot of, I've said this on other podcasts too, where like, I love pitchers who who have like 5.5 ERAs. I'm not saying he has a 5.5 ERA, but his underlying peripherals suggest he should be, more of like a 5+ ERA guy. I like pitchers like that because generally what happens is they change something very quickly. So I mean, you have to, right? Like, yeah. You can't be a 5.2 pitcher in the bigs, especially if you're a younger pitcher. Like, he has experience, so like they'll give him more of a leash. You know, he has over 1,000 innings in the majors, so they're not going to pull him out of the rotation if his underlying peripheral say the 5 ERA pitcher. Like, he needs to be in that rotation. He's going to throw almost 200 innings a year. So I like guys who don't perform well because you're going to see something change. I wonder whether we're getting to the point with that with Berríos, where you have a highest homer rate of his career he's tracking for right now. In a sample over 100 innings, you know, his strikeout rate's the lowest it's been in his career, and his walk rate's up relative to the last three seasons. So those things sum up into FIP, fielder independent pitching, which is just trying to look at what the pitcher controls. And they don't look good relative to the prior couple of years. So although I could only see that the slur was in a different spot and perhaps that's affecting everything else, like maybe there's something else on the underlying side here that if you're another team, you'd flip, or if the Blue Jays, you should flip or play with in order to have him perform at a level that is more to his season and, his career, which is like a 4 ERA guy, sub-4. Like, he's been in that window to the last three seasons. This season seems to be like the 2022 outlier, which wasn't really good results, and he struggled for the sample of innings he threw. So it's tough. Like, this is a piece you, like, beginning of the season, you have a sample of innings that you need to cover, whether it be, you know, it's right around like 1,500 or something like that. And like, you slot him in probably for like 180, 200 of that. So it's hard when you have him underperforming because you can't just like flip him out. It's not like Bowden Francis could step in and throw the final 60 innings he needs to get to that 200 and be the same kind of pitcher he's been. So it's like, it's tough in this respect where it's like, you got to figure something out here. I don't have anything off the top of my head aside from the location, which is makes it a little bit difficult to be like, change mix, change this, change that. It's just the fastballs kind of get beat up in the spots they're thrown. And I think the slurve's in a wrong spot. So I maybe it's fastball variance and some playing with location. That seems to always be like the lowest hanging fruit, I would say.
There's also, yeah, the other thing that's on my mind, at least a little bit, is since he became a full-time pitcher in the majors in 2017, almost nobody has thrown more innings than Jose Berríos. Exactly. And more pitches and things like that. So I don't know, maybe you're just tired. Okay, so you're a little slower to change something with Jose Berríos' track record. The Houston Astros get their hands on Yusei Kikuchi. And we all like Kikuchi. The stuff's nasty. Pretty good results in Toronto this year until the last couple starts before the deadline. And then the Astros are like, actually, in the first inning, Yusei Kikuchi, it looked bad. And then the Astros are like, all right, change this. Here's 11 strikeouts. Here's a nasty debut. What did you see from Kikuchi's first outing with Houston?
Yeah, I love when pitchers get traded or change teams because the thing you see almost immediately is usage changes. which is generally just like what the team believed from a philosophical standpoint, he should be throwing more to every particular kind of hitter. Now, sometimes you don't see this, right? Zach Eflin's a guy that I thought in his first outing with the Orioles changed up some things, while backed away from the four-seam fastball. He started throwing that again a little bit more. Aaron Civale's a guy who made some changes with the Brewers from the Rays. It's always fun when you go like sharp pitching organization to another sharp pitching organization. Because it's like, ooh, they had differing thoughts. Like, I bet they're looking at a lot of the same things. So I wonder how they came to those different conclusions. With Kikuchi, you see immediately the curveball in particular for him, and I can't believe I caught this, but that pitcher was getting crushed by righties for the last like 2 months. And he was still throwing it like 15% of the time. It's trickled down a little bit, but he was trying to use that pitch a lot. The Astros basically said that is purely an OO pitch for you. It's back to the first thing I said on this hit, right? It's just like, if your curveball isn't like a plus pitch, then like it probably should just be early count. And he used it two times in early counts, and he didn't use it the rest of the game. And a byproduct of that is like you have to backfill the usage. So if you pull down the usage on the pitch that's being thrown 15% of the time, and it's now only being thrown 2% of the time, you have like another 13 percentage points of usage to play with, right? So what they did was pull down the fastball even more. He had the lowest fastball usage, I believe, second lowest of the season for him. It's below 40% for only the second time this year. And they jack up the slider usage to a season high, and he throws a little more changeup than he normally throws. So it's one of those things where it's like, I struggle with this sometimes too, because a lot of the time I'm looking for a pitcher to like strike a couple pitches. Like, am I confident enough in you staying in zone to the point where like you're not going to walk 5 for 9 and be putting a bunch of guys on base, working on the stretch a bunch? The other angle to that is like some guys you can just do this with, where even if the fastball, like his fastball performed, I don't think terribly, and it grades out as a pretty good pitch. So I always think it's funny when organizations pull down the usage on that pitch. You know, especially like it's funny year over year when a guy improves a pitch and you're like, oh, the fastball is better, this is great. And then it's like, oh, the usage came down 10 percentage points because it's still a fastball and it's still going to allow the most damage in his mix. So I always find that stuff so funny, where it's like, oh, I'm so happy this guy finally has a better fastball. And it's like, I actually don't use that as much as you were. You use the better fastball less. You're just seeing that trend over and over and over in baseball. You have the Red Sox tracking for the lowest combined four-seam and sinker usage in the history of the sport right now. And they're going to stay on track for that. You know, and you can say history of the sport, even though we've been tracking this since like 2008-ish, because there's no chance that a team was throwing this low fastball back in like the 50s or the 40s, you know? So anyways, those are the three things they changed immediately with Kikuchi. I'm a bit surprised that, you know, based on the performance he had with the Blue Jays, that he didn't make these changes. I think particularly on the curveball, maybe the fastball stuff's a little more galaxy brain because the pitch was doing well. So this gets back to the point we're talking about with Barrios. Like, if he was having good results or the underlying results were good, it's hard to be like, hey, take this pitch and change it because we think you're going to get beat up. Like, I think most front offices take like the, I don't want to call it the venture capital approach, but the venture capital approach where it's, let's be risk averse, you know? Like, if this guy's performing well, even if the underlying stuff isn't good, like, unless he's young and he's malleable, like, we're not going to change much here. We're going to, like, let him fail first and then change. So I don't know if that crept into kind of the Blue Jays, you know, player development and what is he going to throw side of things, where it's like, you know, the results aren't terrible here. So, like, oh, I don't want to bring down the curveball usage or the fastball usage. So like, let's just maintain him as, like, a 4-ish, 4-plus ERA guy in that window and see what he does and then trade him. And the Astros are like, you know, we see, like, a low 3s ERA guy if he just stops throwing his fastball a lot. So again, it's one start. We got to see how it performs and continues over time, but you always got to do this. It's tough. You don't know if it's matchup based, et cetera. But I think when you have like a confluence of multiple things, you know, low fastball usage, slider up, no curveball, like that seems a little more signal to me, especially if you're bumping up against like extremes of what that guy has done in the given season.
Yeah. And it's to your point about, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it kind of VC brain. It's like, yeah, if a guy throws 96 from the left side also, that's, I'm probably extra risk averse to change that. Cause like, you know, after, if that doesn't work out, like, why'd you tell the guy who throws 96 with a super athletic delivery from the left side to throw that nasty fastball less? There's a little bit of that as well. Quickly before I let you go, Lance, the Jays return for Yusei Kikuchi, Joey Loprofito, Will Wagner, and Jake Bloss. You said you're putting together your top 40 pitching prospects. Jake Bloss on the radar there. Do you like Jake Bloss, and what do you like about him, if so?
Yeah, Bloss is good. I like him a lot. I was a bit surprised that he returned Kikuchi. I think that's the general consensus. It's the general consensus so much that it's made me wonder whether like everyone just has the eval on Bloss wrong.
Yeah.
Because like it's kind of weird that they got Bloss for Kikuchi to the point where like I'm wondering whether the like everyone else in the public space overvalued Bloss. But at the end of the day, I mean, I get why they like him, because there's a lot of things and components here that work. Like, he's a deeper mix guy. He throws a bunch of pitches, cutter, slider, a curveball off that. Like, he's got a little changeup thing, which I think is a split. But I mean, he throws a deep mix. So you go to the angle of like, okay, we're pretty confident that you can kind of spin righties to death and then try to neutralize contact quality to lefties. He has some release traits that are good. You know, he has big extension, not like crazy outlier extension, but it's a bit above average, which helps pull your release height down, which then makes the vertical movement you're getting on your fastball for that release height a little bit better. So like, that's how you get that actual true ride that works really well. This is one of the reasons we saw a guy like Jared Jones take off this year. It's because of that particular point. He added extension, lowered his release, and kept the fastball shape the same. Added a little velo to it, which is always going to help. And then it's like, whoa, this guy's really good now. It's like, yeah, because that works really well. So Bloss has a little of that in him, which I think works nicely. So I like him. Yeah, I think he's a top 30 guy for me in my list right now. I think he's like 27 or 28. He's at the back half of like my 50 future value tier, which is like a 4-3, you know, pitcher in a rotation. And yeah, I think he'll accumulate a decent amount of war over the first like kind of 5-6 years of his control, which is generally how you tier off pitchers, so to speak. So yeah, he's good. He's a good pitcher. I think that he will be solid for the Jays for a pretty good amount of time. So again, I'm a bit surprised they got him for Kikuchi. But we'll see. We'll see if the entire industry is wrong. I feel like there's a general consensus around something. It makes me go, I think I'll just take the other side, which is unfortunate because I think he's a good pitcher. So I've been trying to analyze why I'm wrong. I just can't really find reasons
why. It's also a weird one. It's like, yeah, if it was the White Sox or the Rockies and everyone was against him, be like, okay, that makes sense. But the Astros have a pretty good track record of this stuff. It's like, it's not, again, yeah, like if the White Sox didn't value Garrett Crochet or something like that, like the bad organizations, but the Astros have been pretty good. But that's exciting to hear. Obviously, the hope then becomes, yeah, the Astros figured something out with Kikuchi. He dominates for them. The Jays are right on Jake Bloss. Everybody wins. Everyone's happy. Lance, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. We'll all keep an eye out for that top 40 pitching prospects everywhere. YouTube, Substack. It'll be YouTube video breakdown or Substack or both.
I will be doing like a little reaction to it. Yeah, it'll be on Substack first, though.
All right. We'll check it out. Lance Braz on Substack and YouTube. Thanks, man. Lance Brazdowski, Lance Braz on YouTube. Again, you can subscribe to the Substack daily pitcher notes and things like pitchers changing their usage, their shape, their location. Definitely strong recommend. Follow on Twitter as well. Just makes you a much, much smarter baseball fan as you're trying to watch these pitchers and figure out, you know, I mean, hey, some of it is easy to figure out. Oh, I throw 99 and here's my fastball. Like Nate Pearson's not that tough a guy to figure out. I throw 100, dare you to hit it, you know, at its base level. But with some of these more niche things, especially on the starter side, when you're getting into pitch mix and hey, locate this here against this type of hitter, locate that here against that type of hitter. Yeah, can't recommend Lance's work enough. We're going to take a break. I'm going back. We'll wrap up this Yankees Jays series with Emmanuel Barbari, the play-by-play voice of the Yankees on the radio. See where the Yankees are at. Midway through this homestand, they are still tied with the Orioles atop the AL East. This 9-game stretch is probably their best opportunity to take a little lead in the American League East. Jays didn't do them quite as many favors as maybe the Yankees were hoping. I think they were probably looking at that one as a possible sweep. Instead, they just take 2 of 3. We'll take a break. We'll see what Emmanuel thinks of it as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays lose 2 of 3 against the Yankees. They win the Friday game. They drop Saturday. They drop Sunday in extras after a rain delay. I don't know. It's the Jays against the Yankees. The Jays are selling and the Yankees are real good. The Jays are 15 and a half games back. I don't know. I don't know what we expected, but I don't know. Hard enough fought series. You take them to extras in the rubber match there. I'm sure the Yankees were looking at this one as a possible sweep as they start a pretty pivotal 9-game homestand. Let's go down to New York and see how Emmanuel Barbari's feeling about it. He is the play-by-play voice of the Yankees on the radio at WFAN. Emmanuel, what's going on, man? How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Blake? Good to have me.
I'm doing well. Thank you for coming on. And I'm going to bait and switch here. We told you, yeah, we'll talk Yankees-Jays. The real reason you are former Cape Cod roommates with Ben Shulman, who calls the games here in Toronto. I just want the dirt. I want the hot Ben Shulman gossip. What's going on? What was that experience like?
I wish I could give you something that would completely knock Ben down a peg, but you know, he did a tremendous job this weekend. We were sitting and having some meals. We were down on the field. We were in the clubhouse, and I was just in awe of the job that Ben Shulman was doing this weekend on Blue Jays TV. So as we go through this interview, I'll try to think of some dirt, but right now there's none I could shovel his way.
Well, it's cool though that story. You guys, you know, having done the Cape games together and things like that, and now two of the youngest voices in all of Major League Baseball on the play-by-play side. How has this year gone for you? I know you got your feet wet with some games filling in last year, but with John Sterling's retirement, you know, the gig is yours on a more full-time basis this year. How has the season gone for you?
Yeah, it's been an incredible, surreal experience. And like you said, those games where it's Yankees Jays and Ben and I are doing games on opposite broadcasts, that's been one of the surreal aspects of it, where you run into people, Ben being a top example, that things sort of come full circle for you. And I think the entire experience has been that way, where you look around the ballpark and you look around Yankee Stadium and you think, wow, like, this is Yankee baseball. This is Yankee Stadium. Doesn't really get much better than this. So I think just reflecting on it, that's been the coolest aspect of it, is the pageantry and looking around the ballpark and big crowds and big environments. And you're there trying to bring them to life in the best way that you can. But just the opportunity with this team too, which is, sure, they went through some bumps for a month plus going into this month, but overall it's been a really special ride this year. So it's been fun baseball to call. It's always better to be delivering good news.
Yeah, I would like to get back to that at some point in the next couple of years here in Toronto as well.
I'm sure you will.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. And like you said, this is a Yankees team that has had some ups and downs, but played some pretty good baseball lately. So good, in fact, in the case of Aaron Judge, that the Blue Jays intentionally walked him four times this weekend, including three in one game and once with nobody on and two out. Obviously, John Schneider got asked about that a lot. Aaron Boone got asked about it a lot. What did you make of the Jays, you know, really pushing the Aaron Judge intentional walk level to like Barry Bonds territory this weekend?
Yeah, now Aaron Boone is calling it. Went from the Bonds treatment, now we got the Judge treatment. So yeah, I think it's officially a thing where teams are going to follow that model. I don't have an issue with it, because I think about it from the opposing team standpoint. Sure, I want to see Aaron Judge swing the bat. Sure, I want to see Aaron Judge hit home runs. But if I'm the opposing manager, it's gone to such a ridiculous level. And I just think about the first two games this weekend. That's a small micro fraction of what we've seen this season and the last 3 years from Aaron Judge. He hits that ball 477 feet off Kevin Gausman on Friday. Just a complete missile, no doubter. And that was a pitch that was middle, and he leaned back and he hit it out. But then Saturday, they go inside, and it's almost a pitch under the hands, and he still hits it into the bullpen. So at that point, you're probably thinking, how do we actually get this guy out? If we go outside the zone, he's probably not expanding the zone. If we go in the zone, he's hitting something really hard. That time, they actually went out of the zone, and he hit a home run. So better to put four fingers up, put him on first base. So when I go opposing vantage point, I have no issue with it at all.
No, and it's funny. Someone who wasn't watching the series might look and be like, okay, well, he came up 15 times. He walked six times. The Jays must not have pitched him that much. He must not have done much. Oh, by the way, he hit two home runs and had five hits in this series as well. So you see the evidence there. From a Yankees perspective, obviously Juan Soto is in that lineup as well, and that's a big factor there, Soto hitting in front of Judge and making sure, you know, 40% of the time, 45% of the time, Judge has got someone on base for him to make those decisions even tougher. What does that Judge treatment do for the rest of this lineup, for guys like Wells, Stanton, Jazz Chisholm, who, you know, I'd imagine there's a, it's good, everyone probably likes to hit with runners on base, but there's I'd imagine an element of added pressure there, given that, you know, these teams are betting that you won't make them pay for putting Aaron Judge on base.
Yeah, the added pressure argument I look at way more as to where this team was a couple of weeks ago, where you really didn't have the cleanup spot figured out. I still don't think they're in a spot where they're like deadlocked on their lineup and saying this is the lineup we're going to roll out every single day. But they're in a much better place now, and especially with the way Wells has hit the last, not even the last 3 weeks where he's been red hot, But you look at the last couple of months since the slowest start to the season, Wells has been, you could argue, the best offensive producing catcher in baseball just over the last couple of months. So they have to be pretty happy with the production behind Judge now. And then you also add a Jazz Chisholm. You have Gleyber Torres swinging a much hotter bat. We understand what happened on Friday night with Gleyber, but that doesn't take away from the fact that he's been swinging a much better bat since the first time he was sat down for a couple of days, which was, I believe, in late June around the Toronto series when they went to Toronto. And I just think this lineup is deeper, and they have different guys who can get it done at this stage. So, yeah, there could be a little added focus on, okay, who's going to get it done behind Judge, because Soto isn't hitting behind Judge. It's Wells or whoever you slot into the number four spot, maybe Stanton against a lefty hitter. But they have a few guys with that track record of getting the job done where it's going to be on them. But I don't think they all feel pressure, because if they don't get it done, the guy behind them probably can.
Yeah, and that's got to be a good feeling when things are going well to have that. And you're right, man. I've been like the Austin Wells resurgence, I think, since like the start of June, basically. And then since the halfway point, like a 173 OPS plus, pretty and that's coming from the catcher position. Pretty ridiculous stuff there. Also hitting well this weekend was Anthony Volpe, who is, you know, obviously in the lower part of that lineup. He's in there for the shortstop defense and things like that. He has now gotten his OPS plus on the season back north of Lee of 100. So, you know, that 715 OPS, just around league average. What could Volpe turning it around at the plate do for kind of the bottom of this lineup and the way it rolls over?
Yeah, that's something we did not mention, because Volpe has been hitting 5, 6, or 7, but now has been hitting 8, 9, and has been hitting. They had an amazing clip since the All-Star break. And he said he didn't really change much. He's just in a better position mechanically, which is something he corrected a few weeks ago to launch that swing. And it's a much more level swing, but you can sense when he gets a mistake now, he's swinging harder and he's pummeling that mistake. And I just think he's in a better position, as Aaron Boone was putting it, to get that swing off. So Volpe is such a key to this team, where even earlier in the season when they didn't have Jazz, when Gleyber wasn't hitting, when Stanton was hurt, when maybe Wells wasn't doing it at quite this clip and the Yankees were losing a ton of games between June and early July, I think Volpe and Verdugo in particular were the keys to, okay, early in the season they were really hitting. Volpe had an OPS above 800 early in the season when they exited that West Coast trip, which was sort of an apex of the season in May. And then Verdugo was getting timely hit after timely hit after timely hit. So those two were sort of energizer bunnies in the lineup. Volpe was hitting leadoff for a vast majority of the season. Verdugo was hitting fourth, protecting Aaron Judge, and both were doing a fine job at it. So when they started to not hit and other guys got hurt and were scuffling either or, it became a real struggle for this lineup. So even though you have reinforcements there and Stanton's back and Wells is really hitting and Jazz Chisholm's a part of the team and Gleyber's starting to hit, I still put emphasis on Volpe and Verdugo, because I think when those two guys go, this team really goes and there's a different energy with the team. So if Volpe keeps this going, and look, with his defense at shortstop, which is elite as we know, if he could even have a 750 OPS, I think this is one of the better players in the league. So the fact that it's at 715 with all he's gone through, I think the Yankees have to feel pretty good about the season he's having, but they want him to keep that foot on the gas. He gets still 2 months to maybe make it an even more special season.
So something else the Yankees probably feel pretty good about, I'd imagine, is Gerrit Cole's ability to get through 5+ on Sunday. We heard coming in, hey, they might be cautious with the pitch count and things like that, given he had missed his last start with general soreness. He looked pretty good to my eye yesterday. How did he come out of that one? How confident do you think the Yankees will be moving forward that, hey, there's been a lot of innings for Gerrit Cole. There's going to be some fatigue here and there. But I mean, looked like Gerrit Cole yesterday to me.
I think it was an encouraging step when you think about where he's been recently. And remember, going into the All-Star break, he had an elite start in Baltimore. He came out and he dominated Tampa. So it looked like, hey, we're seeing Gerrit Cole. He's back. Then he had that step back against the Mets and then the general body fatigue. He gets shelved, not on the IL, but has to stay out for a start, 10 days of rest into yesterday. And with the way he started, it's not like he was getting, you know, hit all around the ballpark, but the way he started that outing and was laboring just a tad, you might have thought, okay, what do we have here today, and what does this bode for the rest of the season? But quickly responds, settles in, He looked more dominant near the end of that outing. And the fact he gets the fly plus, like you said, you're starting to look at it like, okay, he got through that start. He also worked deep into a pitch count, deeper into a game where you can see this leading to something more, where you get back to the real dominant Gerrit Cole going 6-7, maybe even 8 innings in certain starts. They just want to see him get through it and to look sort of like Gerrit Cole. The stuff was all there. So for him to get through 5-plus with that stuff and commanding, settling into the start and giving the Yankees a chance to win, I think you got to be really pleased. Now we'll see if he can stack like 2 or 3 of these, and the Yankees will think, okay, we got our ace going down the stretch.
And important timing as well, because it seemed like on the other side of the coin, Marcus Stroman has tapered off here a little bit, gives up 7 on the weekend. His 6.32 ERA over his last 10 starts. We know Marcus Stroman pretty well here. We know that he's been in a slump before and pulled his way out of it. What's front of mind for you the next time Marcus Stroman takes the hill, given how rough these last couple weeks have gone for him?
Just in mind for me is how he's commanding both sides of the plate. Clearly the velocity's a hair down, but Stroman's always been a guy, at least recently, where he needs to hit those edges. And when he's going off those edges a little bit, he's going to need guys to expand and to chase, and that hasn't been happening yet. And you can see guys with good bat control, they're just taking the ball where it's pitched, and they're going into the right field corner. I think Vlad on Friday, there was a prime example of that early on where he just took a pitch down the right field line. I just need to see the pinpoint command from Stroman. He says it's something mechanically, but he also says it's something mechanically where he's been through it and he knows what it takes to get out of it. He's just got to find it within himself to repeat enough where he feels in a fluid spot mechanically. So you trust the veteran's word at that, especially when they've been through it before. But it all comes down to the pinpoint command, because he doesn't have that plus fastball or sinker, if you will, or sinker cutter a lot now, where he can leave it middle of the plate and get away with it. That's not who he is at this stage of his career. So you got to see a little bit more of that, because right now it's just a little too hittable. And that's why you're seeing some of these starts where he's not getting out of the third or fourth inning.
Yeah, and that short outing combined with an extra inning game and a rain delay on Sunday, this is a pretty heavily worked bullpen, but they went 14 2/3 in this series, giving up just 2 runs, up to 4th in Major League Baseball in bullpen ERA. So maybe there's even a silver lining in that. Emmanuel, before I let you go here, so the Yankees win 2 of 3 in the series. They remain tied with the Orioles atop the American League East. This homestand continues with 3 more against the Angels and then the Rangers, and the Jays being at the start of this. You know, that as a 9-game homestand, has this kind of window here been looked at as, I mean, they won't write it off, obviously, if they don't do well over this homestand, but this is the opportunity to take some ground back in the AL East, I'd imagine?
From a fan standpoint, I think it definitely looks that way. From a player's standpoint, I don't think you can look at it too much. You're excited to be home. You're excited to get into a rhythm. Most of this month, like 80% of it, is at Yankee Stadium. So I think the players have to be excited about getting into that rhythm and routine and playing at Yankee Stadium in a home ballpark that's favorable to the Yankees historically. But I think that's more of fans talk, where you're saying, oh, look at all these sub-500 teams, and let's beef up. Let's make up some ground or gain some ground ahead of September, where it's not a terrible September schedule in terms of how challenging it is for the Yankees this year. But a lot of teams who could be playing for something, like fringe playoff teams, who if the cards, you know, if the deck is assembled the right way, they could be playing for their postseason lives and against the Yankees in September. So it's a challenging schedule in some ways in September. So I looked at the schedule the other day. I was actually talking with the Spanish language announcer for the Yankees, Ricky Ricardo, who's done some games in English as well. And we were mapping it out from a fan standpoint. We were saying, what do they need to go in August to feel really good about themselves going into September? And we both came up with, if they go 18-9 in 27 games in August with some of these teams, they'll feel really good, because then I think they only need 15 wins, 15-10 in September, and they'd be at 98 or 99 wins, I think is what we came up with. So if they really do beef up on this and go 18-9, they could exit August with a 3 or 4 game lead atop the division, and then all of a sudden you're not relied upon to have this massive September to come away with the ALE. So I would agree it is important to win some of these games and to take advantage, but all you can do, take it one series at a time. There's a cliche, and they were winning a ton of series early in the year. I think they were 16-2-2 in their first 20 series, and they went in a little bit of a tailspin. So if they could just win series each time out, that's 2 out of 3, and that's 18-9, like we were talking about.
Yeah, and look, you're going to – even the bad teams are hungry. You'll get the Angels here and then the Rangers. And then, right. Hey, the White Sox, who at that point could be on a 25-game losing streak, and they'll be hungry for that one. Emmanuel, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Blake. Appreciate you having me.
Emmanuel Barbari, play-by-play voice of the Yankees on the radio side at WFAN in New York. Really enjoy his work. And yeah, I mean, John Sterling's retirement. We all love listening to John Sterling, but the Yankees have done pretty well finding new voices there to help fill that John Sterling void. And yeah, the Yankees playing some pretty good baseball. It's a pretty crazy August schedule. So they get this Jays, then they're going to be at home against the Angels, at home against the Rangers, on the road against the White Sox and Tigers. Then they come back home. They've got a Cleveland series, yes, but then they've got the Rockies, and then they're at the Nationals. It's as far as a contender trying to win a division goes, that's the August schedule you're asking for. And yes, I was not exaggerating about the White Sox. They have now lost 20 games in a row. They have 5 games this week. Remember back to the only like good week the Jays had all season? They played the White Sox like 7 times in a 10-game stretch. Yeah, the White Sox are 27-87, 60 games below 500. And get this, they can't pick in the top of the draft because of the new draft lottery rules about teams being in there multiple times, and you can't, you know, bottom out budget-wise and things like that. They will not be able to get a top pick even in a season where they're 60 games under 500 at the start of August. Ridiculous. Let's take a break. Let's keep it rolling on Jays Talk Plus with Dan Zimborski and Leo Morgenstern on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Hope you're having a nice holiday Monday. If it is a holiday for you, it is obviously not for us. We're on. The Jays are off, though. Always one of my pet peeve MLB scheduling quirks. I know scheduling 162 games for 30 teams and travel and arena availability and all that stuff is very, very difficult. But anytime you have a Canadian holiday and the Canadian team is A, not playing, and B, especially not playing at home, I scratch my head a little bit. Don't know what's going on there. Let's see what's going on with Dan Zimborski of Fangraphs. He joins us now. Dan, what's up, man? How are you?
Hey, Blake, how's it going?
I am I'm pretty well. Had to have you on today because the Blue Jays Fangraphs playoff odds have dropped to 0.1%. And if I read the Fangraphs bylaws correct, once it drops to 0.0, I'm ineligible to have you on the show.
Yeah, I guess... Oh, there's no hope. Let's call Zimborski. They always have me play the devil's advocate whenever anything's going too nicely. It's like, oh, we're all happy about the team. Let's call Zimborski.
Well, this is kind of the role of you and projection models in general is never too high, never too low, right? Because even if that's true that you bring it down when people are too excited, you got to bring it up when people are doomsdaying, right? Except for the White Sox.
Well, it is definitely doomsday for the White Sox. But I guess on one level, if you're going to be terrible, be really, really good at being terrible. And the White Sox are mastering that as we speak.
Which is fascinating. 20-game losing streak, 60 games below 500 here in early August. And yeah, because of the draft and lottery rules, they cannot pick earlier than 10th. In 2025. So not exactly a silver lining at the end of this one, Dan, for them.
No. And I mean, to an extent, their trade deadline didn't even go as great as it could have. You had Garrett Crochet putting in his demands at the last minute, which kind of scared off the market, I'm sure. They never really got the package they would want in return for trading someone like Luis Robert. I think the White Sox, I mean, they actually do have a chance at losing 120 games. For a while, it looked like they were just going to be a normal bad team after the horrible start, but they've kind of gone back to that. And as an Orioles fan, I'm happy to see them if they defeat the O's record. I would really like that.
So have you, is this like too gross? Have you dug in on like the, like obviously there are Fangraphs playoff odds, and within that we can see outcomes for the teams that aren't playoff bound as well. Like, what are the chances the White Sox break this futility record, modern era futility record, asterisk there?
It's still a long shot because the basic issue is that the difference between a good team and a bad team is a lot smaller in 2024 than it was, say, in 1924. So it's a little hard to be epically awful. But the White Sox right now do have 5-6% chance of winning 100. Losing 120 games. Winning 120 games, I don't know if they would even do that like before the end of 2025. But they do have a pretty good shot. I mean, a 5-6%. I mean, that doesn't sound like a lot to some people, but that's the odds of a 30 home run hitter hitting a homer in any given plate appearance. Is nobody shocked? Like when, say, Pete Alonso hits a home run this year, it's not the craziest thing that ever happened. So the White Sox could be the best at being bad since the Cleveland Spiders. Maybe it's, I wouldn't say fun to watch, but it's amusing, I guess.
Yeah, I would say it's not, like, until they get to that point, I'm not actually watching the White Sox. I'm not tuning in for the White Sox. It's fun to track and monitor. Don't imagine they are although I guess if you're playing against the White Sox, it's a good series to watch. I mentioned it earlier. It was the Jays' only really good 2-week stretch of the season. It included 7 White Sox games in like a 10-day stretch. Dan, let's talk about real teams that actually win some games. Let's talk about the trade deadline. And yeah, it was a week ago now, but we haven't gotten to dive in on many of the non-Blue Jays teams here yet. You did your annual piece, which I think is one of the most valuable pieces of the baseball season, which is zipsing up the trade deadline. Hey, what's everyone's playoff odds now that the deadline's over versus before? What's everyone's World Series odds now that the deadline's over versus before? To start it off, no team gained more in playoff odds based on that model than the Kansas City Royals at an 8.5% playoff odd boost. Were you surprised to see them at the top of the list when you ran the numbers?
I wasn't super surprised simply because I've done this for a long time. And you're when you do the projections, you're kind of aware of some of the interactions between bad teams getting worse and making you better, because the Royals, they didn't add any big names, but they're kind of a team that's on the cusp. The teams they play a lot got a lot worse, and you know, they simply had more room to gain percentage points in playoff percentage than, say, Cleveland, which is a team that is already, you know, very, 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 very likely to make the playoffs. So the Royals did well by just doing small incremental gains while the competition was blowing themselves up, especially the Rays, one of the biggest blowups, but I guess we'll get to that.
Yeah, that's part of the impact of, hey, oh, the Jays, you know, bowed out of their final 3% of playoff odds. The Rays bowed out of their 20% or whatever. Those have to go other places. So even if your big addition was Michael Lorenzen and Paul DeJong and Lucas Erceg, you can see a nice bump in the playoff odds. Another team that saw a pretty good odds bump, and this is in part because of that same effect. If you're an American League East team and the Jays and Rays take a step back, of course, the Red Sox are going to look a little better given, you know, schedule remaining and things like that. The Red Sox also added Danny Jansen and a couple other pieces. The Zips model really likes Danny Jansen in Fenway the rest of the way here. Did you like that addition for them as well? Or did that one, raise an eyebrow for you? It really likes Danny Jansen rest of season.
I like the Jansen acquisition for the Red Sox. I didn't really like the other moves they made. Some of the bullpen moves were kind of water treading, I guess, to be nice about it. But in an extent, when you're treading water and your competition is blowing up, that's kind of beneficial. So these are like the consequences of the Rays, because again, the Rays did have decent playoff odds before the deadline, and they have much worse ones after. It's probably one of the biggest, you know, sell-offs for a contending team that we've seen. But the Red Sox kind of stayed in their lane. They didn't do anything great, but they didn't do anything to self-damage themselves. So Boston still has a pretty good shot. I mean, they're not my favorite team when you talk about the wild card contenders.
Yeah, I mean, and this is a Toronto show, so while you have admitted to being an Orioles fan on this show in the past, I'm sure you've won the people back by saying you don't exactly like the Red Sox in the playoffs. So there's a good push-pull going on here. If we look at the other East Division, Dan, it was a noisy National League East trade deadline. The Braves obviously dealing with tons of injuries and trying to fortify that. The Phillies losing a ton of games lately, but the Braves can't catch up. The Mets hanging around the periphery of the wild card race there. What do you make of how the NL East looks right now and the moves those teams did or didn't make at the deadline?
Well, for the Mets, the Braves, they didn't do that much, but it's simply a case that Jorge Soler was such a pressing need that even though it isn't the most exciting transaction, it was a pretty crucial one for the Braves because they have gotten nothing out of their outfield this year. They've been, below replacement level, and that's with Acuña being okay, at least for the first before his most recent ACL tear. I would have liked to see the Braves do more. They probably, if they had added a picture, like if they had been the team to add Zach Eflin, they probably would be the team that got the biggest bump simply again because their competition in the NL wildcard wasn't exactly all that active. And, of course, the Mets were a team that even more needed improvements than the Braves, and they did make some pretty good incremental improvements. The Mets were one of the more active teams, but there's kind of a theme in this trade deadline is there weren't that many big stars traded, and one of them, Isaac Paredes, whether you call him a star or not, his impact is more in 2025 for the Cubs than 2024 because their odds are already so long that it's just not that much. It's a little too late.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and that one seemed more about future years as well because he's obviously arbitration controllable and things like that. With respect to the Soler addition, how do you think the conversations went with the Braves and Soler and Ozuna deciding which one of those guys would have to play the outfield? Like, Soler had not played the outfield this year and is a minus 55 defensive run saved for his career. Ozuna hasn't played the outfield this year and like only played a couple innings of left last year, but at least when he was last the fielder, he was not good, but like not as bad as Jorge Soler. Did they just rock, paper, scissors for this or what?
maybe they have some kind of weird race and whoever is last gets to like, you guys are going to run from here to that fence over there. Whoever takes the longest will be the DH.
tough one there for those guys. Okay, on the seller side of things, look, there are obviously teams that bowed out of the race. The Giants did it a little bit. The Jays, the writing was on the wall, but you make eight trades, you sacrifice all but a shred of those playoff odds. And then there's the Tampa Bay Rays, who dropped about 19 or 20% in playoff odds. I know it's the Rays. There are market factors. They're trying to be realistic about, what does 20% actually mean in the big picture and stuff like that. But you kind of mentioned it. We haven't really seen a team. I mean, have you seen a team that proximal to the playoff race sell off like that before and basically distribute 20% playoff chance around the rest of the American League like that before?
Well, since I've been doing the projections, and Zips has been around now for nearly 20, well, it is around for 20 years because I'm getting very old and depressed about it as I speak this sentence. But it is the largest drop off that I've seen over this time. I talked a little about the White Sox, the infamous white flag trade that they made with the Giants in 1997. And that was actually a much smaller drop when I went back and projected it in hindsight. And that was an infamous trade. And the Rays, they did trade a lot. And my kind of feeling about it is if you were getting great prospects, I can understand it, but it's not like they prospects they got were amazing. So I'm really kind of about that. And I'm usually not that ambivalent about Rays moves. Usually they do tend to be pretty good at seeing the goal. So I have some mixed emotions, let's just say, about them.
Yeah. It's again, I can understand it, but, I don't know. If I were a Rays fan, it probably would have hurt a little bit. So the other element of this, we've talked about these first couple teams through the lens of playoff odds. Now, the other thing that changes is your World Series outlook. And this is one where your Baltimore Orioles get more interesting because the Orioles were already pretty locked in. Like, even if they don't win the AL East, they're making the playoffs. but they had by far the biggest bump in World Series odds. Only them and the Dodgers saw greater than a 1% boost in World Series odds. That feel right to you for the Orioles that, hey, yeah, these moves weren't focused on making the playoffs. They're what is a playoff series? What do multiple playoff series look like for this team? And I guess just more to the fandom side of it, how nice was it to see them actually be buyers? I know they made the Corbin Burns move in the offseason, but last deadline, we were all kind of sitting there waiting, and it's happening now. They're putting that aggression in with the window open as it is.
Yeah, one of the complaints that Zips had about the Orioles when projecting them, really for most of the season, is that the playoff rotation still looked kind of weak in the back end. Burns and Grayson Rodriguez are a terrific 1-2, but then there was a huge drop-off after that, especially because of some of the injuries they've had that have taken some of the options off the table. I mean, there's a good argument to be made that Kyle Bradish was a breakout candidate, but he's injured now and he's not on the roster. And after Burns and Rodriguez, you're saying, okay, do I really feel comfortable with Dean Kramer being my third starter in a playoffs? Is Cole Irvin going to get back in the rotation? Obviously he's gone now, but those are the bringing in Zach Eflin really finally gives the Orioles rotation some clarity. And it also, you know, adds to their divisional probability too, because that's a pretty big deal that because you're either going to get a bye or they're not, because they've won a lot of games, and that missing the division, I mean, it drops your playoff probability in half just from the having to play that extra round that has a lot of swing in the odds. So the Orioles are in a good position, and so are the Dodgers. Jack Flaherty adds a little more certainty to a rotation that has a lot of questions. The Dodgers kind of like to juggle their great arms that are always injured and hope they have enough healthy at any given time. And Flaherty makes that more likely, and it kind of reduces those downside scenarios for them.
So when we look at the cost these teams paid to add, a lot of it is in future value. It's prospect, 89 prospects dealt at the deadline in all of these trades. If you're the Blue Jays, you know, you can't look at your 2024 playoff odds or Zips projections or things like that to evaluate the return. What are you looking at when you go through the return? I know Zips has its own prospect list as well, in addition to the one Eric Longenhagen and company do for you guys at Fangraphs. When you're going through, hey, this is what Jimmy Garcia brought back, this is what Carlos Estevez brought back, what are you looking for in those returns, Dan?
Well, generally speaking, the better the return is, the better. But very few prospects that were ranked highly were actually traded in at the deadline. And that's kind of a trend in baseball. Teams value prospects a lot more than they did 30 years ago when I started really getting interested analytically in the game on the internet. I think because back then there was kind of an idea that veteran players are proven and prospects are not, but proven is kind of a weird word in baseball because no one's really proven. You see, you know, veterans collapse all the time. Miguel Cabrera was proven until his bat disappeared for the last several years of his career, or same with Albert Pujols. So you look for, you know, value in return for the players you give up. Now the Jays did pretty well with Kikuchi. He's kind of the only guy who got one of the team's absolute best prospects. And I'm a little surprised by that because no one really says, oh, Kikuchi, he's the guy who's going to land the package. So the Jays did do well there in their return.
They did. That seems to be the industry consensus, you know, 13 prospects back in over the course of 8 trades. And probabilistically, you know, you get 13 guys back, it improves the chances that one or two or three of these guys end up being major leaguers, which is important as well. I know you had Jonathan Clase on your top 50 Zips list. What do you like about him? What is Zips like? Is he kind of a fourth outfielder type, and that's still a pretty good return for Jimmy Garcia, or is there potential for more there with Class A?
I'm not quite as high on him as Zips is. Zips does think he can be a borderline starter, and of course, that's what you ask for any prospect. But I think what it comes down to is that the Jays did not trade, you know, Bo Bichette or Vladimir Guerrero for him. They traded a few months of a reliever, and anytime you can get a decent prospect for a reliever who's going to be gone and it isn't making you go in the playoffs either way, you have to consider that a win. I think that considering who they traded, the Jays, I mean, did really well because when you look at at Class A, he's not a bad prospect. He's, you know, it's not like you acquired Jackson Holliday, but as you say, you have a lot of prospects. You add 13 guys. Some of them will work out, and the Jays will feel, if anyone feels poorly about these trades, will feel a lot better then.
Yeah, I think that's you know, that's a good way to look at it. And again, probabilistically, the more guys you get back, the likelier it is someone turns into something. Dan, when we reset on the 2025 Jays here, the idea was obviously, well, they're going to sell it at the 2024 trade deadline. Season hasn't gone the way they hoped, but they intend to compete again next year. And the only pieces under contract for 2025 that they traded away were Nate Pearson and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. When you look at who's still under contract and the way this season has gone, how difficult do you think that will be for the Blue Jays to retool and be competitive again in 2025?
Since they still have a lot of the reasons that they look to be competitive, they're not in a bad case, not in a bad place. But I do think that they need to be a little more aggressive this offseason at spending than they were last season. Because admittedly, to fill the holes last year, they did kind of slum it a bit. They addressed their holes as cheaply as they could. And like, you know, Isaac Kiner-Falefa worked out, you know, shockingly well. But you look at them, they still need probably another starting pitcher. They are going to have to redo their bullpen to get it back so it can contend. And I think you're not going to go into the season with like Ernie Clement at third base. Hopefully, there is a lot of work to do. They will have to pick up an outfielder. They might need to pick up a DH. There are things they need to do.
Have you looked ahead yet to what the 2025 free agent class looks like? I have started to do this research of, yeah, you got a lot of work to do, probably need a starter and two impact bats. Is this a good offseason for that? The answer is, for the most part, always no, because good players get locked up and free agency is inefficient and things like that. Have you looked ahead to that 2025 market yet, though?
It probably won't happen, but there is one really good outfielder.
There sure is.
I don't think anyone would complain if Juan Soto fell to Toronto. Who knows? It's kind of a light offseason for offensive players, especially. You can always get relievers, but you look at the big bats, and there are a lot of questions because once you get past Soto, I mean, you're talking about Pete Alonso, I'm not sure I want to pay him Freddie Freeman, Matt Olson money. That sounds a little scary, considering he's not even a superstar right now. And then, of course, I mean, Cody Bellinger could opt out, but he probably shouldn't. Marcelo Ozuna has a club option. That's going to be picked up. It's not a great market for bats. I mean, Gleyber Torres is probably one of the elite offensive players available, which is kind of sad in a way, I guess.
Yeah, it's not great. Speaking of those player comps you mentioned for Pete Alonso. So Matt Olson got 8 years, 168. Freddie Freeman got 6 years, 162. On the third base side, Rafael Devers got like 10 years, 325 or something like that. Where are you? I feel like we need to temperature check on Vlad because we've had you on in times when Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is hitting poorly and Zips has been like, no, like he's Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Like he's not going to get back to 2021 level, but you know, he's a really good hitter. And now his WRC plus on the season, Dan. So for the audience, like a stat that takes everything you do offensively, control for league factors, park factors, and things like that. It is almost as high as it was in 2021. His OPS on the season up to 926 now. Now, Vlad has one more year of control through arbitration as a Super 2. But what do you... I know you kicked around in a piece at Fangraphs, as you always do at the start of season, potential extensions for Vlad and Bo and guys like that. And it was hard to find a number. I'd imagine it's got to be even harder to figure out a number at this point because he's turned it around since the start of May and is kind of back to that, almost to that 2021 level.
Yeah, he's and it feels good because, you know, for like a year and a half, I've been saying, don't worry, the home runs will come back. The advanced stats say so. And then the home runs were continuing to not come back. But I mean, he's one of the players who's probably earned the most money in future earnings in the last 3 months or so, because he has been terrific. And I think the strategy that the Blue Jays take in 2025, I think it kind of goes through an extension for Guerrero and Bichette, because if you can't close that, and I think that if you want to keep them, the best time is before they hit free agency, because once you're in an auction situation, you know, all bets are off. That's going to determine what they do in 2025, because do they go all in for one last season? Or if they can't do an extension and they won't go all in, then you do have to consider revisiting the idea of a trade for Vlad and Bichette, because if you're not going to go all in while you have them, there's no real purpose to doing that. I think the Rays are a team that, even if they kind of threw the towel prematurely, they do have that kind of organizational focus about, okay, what does our situation mean right now, and what does the future look like? So this is going to be an interesting offseason for Toronto.
It definitely is. When we look ahead to, you know, part of looking ahead to 2025 is looking at who's still going to be around as well. From a context standpoint, Dan, the Jays are not competing these next 2 months. They're going to give opportunity to a lot of different guys. We're going to see more Leo Jimenez, Ernie Clement, Spencer Horwitz, Davis Schneider, guys like that. How much... I mean, obviously the results matter. What you do at the major league level against major league pitching is really important information. But historically, if a guy comes up and gets 40, 50 games late in the season, how much more information does that give us versus what, you know, their minor league track record told us already as far as projecting them moving forward?
It can be a pretty big deal, especially for the guys who don't have anything more to prove in the minors, because once you've seen a guy, you know, hit AAA pitchers, there's not really much he can do to show you he can play in the majors except play in the majors. he's not going to just beat AAA pitchers up enough that you say that he's ready if you don't already think so. But that's kind of the advantage of being a bad team, is you have the ability to look at players, and hopefully the Blue Jays do look aggressively at some of these question mark guys over some of the older players, even. I think there should be more rest days for pretty much anyone over 30. The team, even after the trades, is still not a young team, generally speaking. There are some old players still getting a lot of playing time. So you can use these months for something productive. And, you know, looking at guys and looking at pictures, looking at relievers, seeing throwing anything out there at the wall and seeing what sticks, that's kind of what their mission should be for 2 months.
Dan, there's one guy specifically I wanted to ask you about, and he was in this spot last year, even though the Jays were competing. Davis Schneider had a really good 35-game debut last season, put himself on the radar for not just for 2023, but for 2024 and moving forward as well. He has had a rough couple of months here. I know he's a guy that the Zips model was always high on. Zips still maintaining some optimism that Davis Schneider can, you know, maybe not 1,000 OPS like he did in a small window last year, but get back to being a more capable hitter than he's shown the last little while.
Yeah, if you look at some of his data, there are some good signs in it. He hasn't played well, but the thing is, at the major league level, it's a constant cycle of playing well, pitchers adjusting, you adjusting, pitchers adjusting. And that's kind of something that you need to see from someone who is going to start for you. Whether he's right now going to be kind of a utility guy or if he's going to be a starting second baseman, I think that you put him out there, you don't bench him no matter what for the rest of the season. And then you go into next season with a better idea of what you have in him. Because even if he isn't a starter, he could still be useful to the team as a spare bat, a guy who can play multiple positions, at least fake it kind of decently. I'm not quite sure which way I go on his future, but again, that's a challenge the Jays have and for August and September.
Yeah. Hey, here's 100 more plate appearances to see what you can figure out. And you don't have to, you know, I don't know, who knows how the lineup shakes out exactly. And if they call up a Will Wagner to take some of the reps or whatever, but a lot of these guys, you know, where it was, hey, if you have a cold week, we don't know where your playing time's coming from. After that, someone else is going to take it. Now you get the breather of like, yeah, you're going to be in there. You're going to be in there most days. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. Glad your Orioles have a little bit better of a chance in that World Series picture. And we'll see them here for a couple days this week. I'd imagine, you know, the Jays do them a little bit of a favor in the AL East race this week as well.
Well, we always have fun. Thanks for having me. Now, I grew up with the O's Jays rivalry in the early 90s, so maybe you guys shouldn't wish them quite as well as
I'm not saying I'm cheering for them, but like my most recent Jays Orioles rivalry memory is the 2016 wild card game, so I'm fine. Zach Britton. Yeah. I'm Zach Britton. I'm just sitting in a chair in the bullpen unused and unbothered. So that's how I feel about that, Dan.
And they're not the Yankees, so I think everyone could agree, hey, we won't love the Orioles, but we'd rather have them than the Yankees.
Exactly. Ideally, it's a team coming out of the AL Central, the AL West, but, you know, as long as it's not the Yankees. Dan, thanks so much, man.
See ya.
Dan Zimborski of Fangraphs. Good guy, good context on the Zip stuff there. Yeah, it's from a model perspective, prospects are always a little harder to get a handle on, but it's always interesting to see what something like a projection model thinks about a guy's ability to come up and contribute. Obviously, lots of guys come up and don't do it. Guys come up and beat their projections and things like that, but it's a helpful level setter when some of these guys first make their debut. You know, hey, Joey Loperfido, what do we expect? And he's an interesting guy when we talk about these small major league samples too, because he is a guy who has absolutely shown he can hit AAA pitching. He got a cup of coffee there at the end of last season, hit okay after raking a AA, and then he was just destroying AAA pitching this year. And now he's up and everyone likes the tools and things like that. And now we're going to see, okay, 38% strikeout rate in 150 plate appearances. That's a pretty big red flag. If that's still the rate after 250 plate appearances, maybe that tells us a little bit more. He is front of mind right now. Will Wagner, the other piece they got back in that trade, just an unbelievable start to his career as a Buffalo Bison. He's been pretty hot down there. And a note on those Buffalo Bisons. Friday, we got a little surprise. Joey Votto pinch hit. And then Saturday, we got a little surprise. Joey Votto pinch hit. He homered on Sunday in a game he started. So Joey Votto's back. He's playing for Buffalo Bisons now. He's gotten into three games. Again, only one start, a couple as a pinch hitter. We'll cover that story more throughout the week. The Bisons are obviously off today, as most minor leagues are on Mondays. But yeah, we'll keep an eye on Votto. We'll keep an eye on the Bisons. Maybe we'll talk to some Bisons a little later in the week. Right now, I'm going to take a break. We go back on the other side. We'll talk to Leo Morgenstern, also of Fangraphs and MLB Trade Rumors. Just fascinated by the MLB Trade Rumors guys and people at the trade deadline and just how much volume they have to churn out. Even at it reminds me of when I was at the Score and was a news editor there. And it's like, yeah, oh, I did 48 articles today. None of them were more than like 300 words, but hey, I did 48 articles today. Let's take a break. Let's see how things shake out in Leo's perspective. We'll talk a little NL East specifically, because the Phillies are a disaster right now, but the Braves and Mets haven't been able to quite catch up. We'll also talk a little bit more Jays, of course, because this is Jays Talk Plus, and it continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network at Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, joined now by the biggest Jonas Brothers fan I know of Fangraphs, of MLB Trade Rumors. It's Leo Morgenstern. Leo, what's up, man?
Hey, good. It's nice to be back.
How you doing? I have busy trade deadline, I would imagine, given you are at both Fangraphs and MLB Trade Rumors.
Yeah, it's a tough day, especially leading up to it. You got to figure out how you're going to split your time, how you're going to help out everybody you need to help out, but it all ended up working out pretty well. It was a tiring day, but
this
got
is
through it and it was exciting.
This is too inside base, with the audience doesn't care about this, but I'm going to ask anyway. It's my show and it's a holiday, so I'm going to ask, what is the workflow like when new trades come up and new transactions? Like, I know a little bit of how it works at Fangraphs, but at MLB Trade Rumors, like, is it just chaos in a Slack? How do you guys determine who's got to write up what?
It's a great question. I mean, usually there's a very strict schedule. There's someone who's on shift and it's their job to cover whatever comes up if news breaks while they're on shift. Trade deadline day is an entirely different story. We have every writer in one big Google chat and it's everyone's following Twitter the whole day. And it's just, as soon as you see a move, you pop it in there. Somebody who isn't already working on something else claims it. usually somebody is already working on five things at once, and it's just who is working on the fewest things at once and is able to help claim it. I did a lot of, you know, like helping out the other people who are already doing so much at once, and I was just happy to be able to pop in there and fill out some articles for them.
Well, there you go. And then there was also a ton of July 31st, of course. Everyone's DFA'd or changing, and the draft pick signing and everything like that. Appreciate all the great work you guys do at MLBTR and at Fangraphs. Let's take a look at the National League East picture right now, because I know in addition to doing league-wide stuff, you got that Phillies focus. They finally won one yesterday. They dropped six in a row. They've dropped 12 of their last 16. Man, what's going on?
Well, I'm not going to give you the big reactionist take that the viewers might be hoping for here. No, I've been saying all season that the reason it's so good that the Phillies are winning so many games is because eventually they're going to go on a losing streak. Eventually they're going to lose a bunch of games. And this time they already have that cushion from all the games they won earlier in the year. I mean, the 2022 Phillies, 2023 Phillies, also great teams. We saw them go on some pretty terrible losing skids, but those happened earlier in the season. And we were stressing all year about whether they were even going to get into the postseason. This year, we don't have to worry about that. And so it's a lot easier to take the losing skid and just kind of let it flush over you, say this happens to every team. They're still in a really strong position. And it's hard to worry too much when a big part of why they're losing is that Bryce Harper isn't hitting, because you know that's not going to last.
Yeah, I'm fairly confident that that's not going to last and that's going to turn around. It's also, you know, if you're looking for reasons of optimism that a team will eventually turn it around, having one of the best rotations in baseball goes a pretty long way. You've got a good chance, I don't know, four times out of five, you got to feel good about your chances there, even with a couple of IL stints right now. And then the Phillies focused on shoring up that bullpen at the deadline. They added Carlos Estevez and Banks as well. How do you feel about, I know you wrote about this for Just Baseball, but how do you feel about where the Phillies bullpen is at this post-deadline spot? I know it's been a good back end, but obviously the hierarchy here is going to juggle up. And no more Sir Anthony Dominguez.
Yeah, well, I think I was originally a little miffed at the deadline because Phillies had a great back end of the bullpen, but their 7-8 guys were not providing so much. And I was kind of presuming you keep Sir Anthony Dominguez, you keep Gregory Soto. Those are high ceiling guys who are struggling a bit this year, that you move down into the lowest leverage roles of your bullpen. And all of a sudden, that's a really great bullpen. And if those guys figure something out, you've got pitchers that batters are going to be scared to hit the entire way through the bullpen. After taking a bit more time to think about it, to digest it, I kind of came to the much more reasonable conclusion that it was a solid deadline. It didn't move the needle all that much. The bullpen got a tiny bit better. But when it comes to the postseason, those 7-8 guys at the back of your bullpen are not playing a very big role. We've seen this with the Phillies and most other teams the past several years. The better guys in your bullpen are taking a much heavier workload in the postseason. So if you can flip Sir Anthony Dominguez so that you don't have to trade prospects to the Orioles in that Austin Hayes trade, if you can flip Gregory Soto and get a couple guys back to replenish the farm system, obviously they're not the same caliber of prospects they sent to the Angels for the Cepes, but you got a little bit back. It was a good market for pitching this year. So the Phillies, they made their bullpen a tiny bit better. We're not talking leaps and bounds, but this team didn't need to get leaps and bounds better. And when it comes to the postseason, you're also going to have, hopefully, Spencer Turnbull back. And it's going to be a pretty strong pitching staff.
Yeah, and maybe one of these starters who won't start in the playoff series. And once, you know, Ranger Suarez is back, one of the moves of the bullpen, et cetera, other ways to come about it. And Carlos Estevez has already given us the quote of the season. However, I can put a grain of sand onto this beautiful beach that these guys built here. What a quote to Matt Gelb of The Athletic from Estevez there. Elsewhere in the NL East, you wrote about the Mets for Fangraphs the other day. Mark Vientos and Jose Iglesias, in Iglesias' case, providing fun, providing the vibes, providing the literal soundtrack. But this Mets team offensively has been pretty good, and it has them still on the periphery of the wild card race. What do you make of their chances here sitting a game and a half out?
Yeah, I mean, the Mets, the reason I wanted to write about it is I kind of started looking at those team-wide offensive numbers, and I realized that the Mets are one of the best offensive teams in the National League, and I don't think they're getting credit for that, because you're taking a team that already had Lindor and Nimmo and J.D. Martinez and Pete Alonso, even when he's not at his best, is still a pretty darn good hitter. And then when you have Vientos and Iglesias stepping up as well, all of a sudden that's a pretty dangerous lineup, almost 1 through 9. So for the Mets, it's going to be entirely about how much the starting pitching can hold up and survive for the rest of the season. Offensively, they can out-hit the Phillies. They can out-hit the Braves, especially the Braves that we're seeing right now. And they're in a pretty solid position to make that wild card. And I think another real hinge for them is if Kodai Senga is back in the playoffs. We heard the Mets say a couple of times he's done for the regular season. And I think they made that regular season point pretty clear. All of a sudden, if you got Senga leading the rotation in the postseason, the Mets are a team to watch out for. And nobody was expecting that a few months ago.
No, return of the Ghost Fork. Let's go. It'd be fun to see. Return of Max Fried, by the way, for the Braves. But yeah, they're so desperate offensively that they not only acquired Jorge Soler, but they'll let him play the outfield, which is always an adventure. And the NL wildcard, for anyone who hasn't taken a look recently, is a mess. So the Braves and Dodgers are in the top two spots, only half a game up on Arizona, who are only a game and a half up on the Mets. And then the Cardinals, Pirates, you know, on the periphery of that, but we got a pretty tight four-team race here for three spots, which will be a lot of fun to track. Moving outside of the NL East here a little bit, you wrote up a couple catcher trades at the deadline. The Jays traded Danny Jansen to the Red Sox, which is off to a nice little start. The Rangers add Carson Kelly. Also, by the way, two of the top free agent catchers this winter. I guess I'm interested in your thought on those two landing spots. But generally, I think last time we had you on, you had just wrote a thing about catchers as well and the back picks. What is it about you being drawn to the catcher write-ups?
Yeah, I wouldn't have immediately thought of myself as someone who's drawn to writing about catchers. And yet, here we are. They're kind of, I guess, catchers are responsible for some of the less talked about aspects of the game. And one thing I really like to bring to my writing is what's something that I find interesting that I don't think enough people are talking about. And the first time it was those catcher back picks. And this time it was thinking about how it's always, pitching is always the top priority at the trade deadline. Teams will end up overpaying for pitchers, as I think I'm sure you've already talked about on the show, the chance that happened. And I was thinking, well, how do you improve your pitching staff without actually adding pitchers? And the answer is to get pretty good defensive catchers. And we saw in both of the big catcher trades that took place at the deadline, the Red Sox getting Danny Jansen, the Rangers getting Carson Kelly, these teams improved their defensive situations behind the plate pretty substantially. And hopefully that's going to help them prevent runs as the rest of throughout the rest of the season.
So obviously the teams that traded away catchers will now have a need for a catcher in the offseason. These teams that acquired them might have. Have you looked at all yet at what the catcher market looks like for the offseason? I did kind of give you a heads up. We're going to be looking at that. This is a more Jays-focused question, because you trade Danny Jansen away, you're obviously going to need a new Danny Jansen come the winter. You're not going Brian Servin and you know, Phil Clark and those guys for a whole season next year.
Well, I think part of the reason the Jays decided to trade away Jansen is that when you have someone like him under arbitration, it's great to have a Kirk and a Jansen on the same team. My guess is that even with Jansen having a bit of a slow stretch in the middle of this year, he's gonna be the top free agent catcher. He's gonna get a multi-year deal. The Blue Jays probably aren't interested in paying someone like that to be their part-time catcher. Even with Kirk struggling, he's still one of the better defensive catchers in baseball. They're not taking Kirk out of that role. Other options you have, Carson Kelly is having a really great season, but he might be having a slightly better year than Jansen right now. He's not going to be, we're not talking about a top free agent here, just based on his track record. Someone who's not proven a consistent ability to be a full-time contributor to a team, but he's a really solid part-time player. Other guys on the market to look at are Elias Diaz and Jacob Stallings, who are both on the Rockies right now, and I should say I'm surprised that one of them wasn't traded at the deadline, but they are in the Rockies, and you absolutely never know what Colorado is going to do, but Colorado has two starting caliber catchers right now. They're completely out of the race. They had absolutely every reason to want to trade one of them, both having pretty solid years. Seems like both of them could have gotten a return based on what we saw with Jansen and Kelly. So they're still playing in Colorado. Ilias Diaz is a free agent at the end of the year. Jacob Stallings has a mutual option, which is unlikely for Colorado to pick up. So those are the other two names that I would be kind of following if you're looking for a guy who can start semi-regularly as a catcher this offseason. But Jansen is still, he still has to be the top name for me.
Yeah, and we'll see how that works out in Boston, where obviously Connor Wong is pretty good too. But Danny Jansen's going to get to play ping pong with the Green Monster there the rest of the way with that Deadpool swing. Maybe it ends up a longer-term fit. From the Blue Jays' perspective, obviously nobody wanted to be in a seller spot when this season started for the Blue Jays. Did you like the work they were able to do, given that that things have gone so poorly?
Yeah, it seems like the Blue Jays did exactly what they needed to do, and especially considering that this was not their plan probably even a couple of months ago, they did pretty smart work to quickly change gears. I think that they targeted some guys who were going to be able to help right away, which was what they had to do if they were going to hold on to Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette and anyone else who's under contract beyond this year. So by getting someone like Jake Bloss from the Astros, who can contribute to the rotation right away, or Joey Loperfido, who can slot into the lineup, the Blue Jays are thinking about the immediate future. And they also got a ton of promising guys. Like, they weren't trading big stars, so they weren't going to get back superstar prospects, but they got a lot of names to follow, like Will Wagner, or is it Jonathan Clase? Some really interesting names there.
Yeah, it's nobody wanted to be here, but you make the best of the situation you're in. And like I've said a couple times, anytime you get 13 prospects back, your odds of even one or two of them hitting go up. Leo, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. It was great to talk to you.
Leo Morgenstern of Fangraphs, of MLB Trade Rumors. Make sure you're checking out all his great work. No Blue Jays action tonight, but again, the interesting decision yesterday in the game against the Yankees. So that one ends up going 10 innings. They lose 4-3 in extras. There was a spot in the fifth inning where Yariel Rodriguez got taken out. He was at 76 pitches, and a couple people have asked about this, so I just wanted to talk about it again. Briefly here before we wrap up. 4 2/3 in, it's Juan Soto. The bases are empty. There's two outs. They take out Yariel Rodriguez. John Schneider, explains after the game that, well, he wasn't going to come back out for the next inning anyway. He was getting close to where they have his rough pitch limit right now. Righty on lefty, obviously. And then in bringing Brandon Little in, if you assume they were going to intentionally walk Aaron Judge anyway, which they obviously were going to do, they intentionally walked him four times on the weekend, including three yesterday. Little had two shots to get out of the inning, lefty on lefty against Soto, lefty and lefty on Austin Wells. It was interesting to hear John Schneider talk about it after the game. We can play that clip right now.
Yeah, every pitcher's upset when I take him out. It's 4 2/3. You're in line for a win. I totally get it. He's at 75 pitches. He wasn't going back out. And looking at it, you trust Little to get a lefty. We weren't pitching a Judge with Little there, so he has two shots to get either Soto or Wells out. And with a day off tomorrow and with a lot of guys available, that was kind of the thinking. He had a really short outing in Baltimore, so didn't really want to push him past where he was anyway.
So a lot of different factors there. I said off the top, I like that Yariel Rodriguez was emotional about it, wanted to stay in the game. The shaking the head, the handing the ball off, the shaking the head, whatever. You want guys out there who want to compete and want to get to go an extra batter and things like that. And Yariel had really settled down after a shaky first inning. So understand the decision. And certainly if he gives up a bomb to Juan Soto and everyone looks after like he was at his pitch limit, it was his third time seeing him, what are you doing? And then there's also, had you saved him and then you bring Brandon Little in there and you intentionally walk Aaron Judge and then he faces Wells, well, then he's got to deal with another righty and Giancarlo after, et cetera, et cetera. These things kind of flow. But I just think it's an interesting thing to hear Schneider's perspective on. And Yariel talked about it through a translator as well, which you can see from Hazel May's tweets or Shai Davidi's write-up from the game. But yeah, he's a he's a competitor and he wants to be out there. And that's my biggest takeaway is you want a guy like that. You want a guy who's even in a season like this, who's intense about it and wants to stay on the mound. He wants to get that final out and things like that. So we'll see. We'll see how he does next time out. It'll be the series starts tomorrow. Of course, it's all 7 o'clock starts down at the Rogers Center. It'll be Chris Bassett against Grayson Rodriguez, Bowden Francis against Trevor Rogers, and Kevin Gausman against Dean Kramer. And yes, Bowden Francis still slated to start Wednesday, even though he was used out of the bullpen in the 10th inning last night. We'll be back tomorrow to set that one up proper. Thank you to Lance Brozdowski for joining us, to Emmanuel Barbari, to Dan Zaborski, to Leo Morgenstern. Thank you to Austin Mackey and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass for helping us out today. We'll fire up some text line stuff tomorrow as well. See how you're feeling. Hope you all have a wonderful holiday Monday. Talk to you tomorrow, guys.